Hello and welcome to Hindsight. I'm Michelle Rayner, with two incredible news stories today about a major figure in our early colonial history. The name Bennelong is etched into the minds of most Australians, even if it only reminds you of that well-known strip of land beneath the Sydney Opera House. But how much do we really know about this Wongal man and his turbulent life, or his extraordinary journey to England and back? And how much remains to be told? Just in the last few months, one historian has uncovered a song that Bennelong sang for his English hosts in 1793. And you'll hear it performed in today's feature. And just last week, a physical geographer located the site of Bennelong's grave under a street in suburban Sydney. It's been lost for almost 200 years. Bennelong has long been cast as a tragic figure, a traitor to his people, as a damaged character in countless Australian histories, novels and narratives. But as more information about him and his contemporaries comes to light, Bennelong is being recast as an adventurer, a politician, a diplomat. And it seems that he's still speaking to us across the centuries in word and song. Here's Bennelong Sings, and it's produced by Lorena Allam.
The next vessel to depart the Harbour Bridge side door is the Zoo Service, stopping at Taronga Zoo only.
I think the character of Bennelong was always in my mind as a child, catching the ferry from Manly to Bennelong Point, and I knew the name. But to me, he was a marvellous character who hadn't been given his due, who was looked on from the historical inheritance as a kind of Uncle Tom, as a kind of collaborator, and I couldn't see it.
That's Keith Vincent Smith, historian and curator. He's been investigating Bennelong's life and his long, traumatic voyage to Britain in 1792. Bennelong was 29 and his companion Yemarawani was just 19 when they agreed to sail to England with Governor Phillip. When Bennelong finally returned to Sydney Cove, he'd been away for almost 3 years, and 18 months of the journey had been spent on board ships, either at sea or stuck in dock. Yemarawani didn't make it home. In London, the two men stayed in Mayfair as guests of Governor Phillip's friend, William Waterhouse. We know quite a bit about what the two men did while they were there. But just last year, Keith Vincent Smith discovered an amazing new detail, a song Bennelong and Yemarawani performed for their hosts. Their neighbour was a man called Edward Jones, who was a musician. He copied down the tune to the song, and here it is, performed as he wrote it for the first time since 1792.
Parabola Barama Mangin Wayanguna Parabola Barama Mangin Wayanguna.
You can see the picture of these two Aboriginal men and Wongal men from the south shore of the Parramatta River. They're in this Georgian townhouse. They had their clapsticks, which are described, and they're singing that song. Marvellous scene. They're dressed in their Regency clothing as they do so. So this is definitely the first song from an Aboriginal aspect ever heard in Europe.
And notated by a musician.
And notated, and the first in which the music was written down, yes. Edward Jones later became the harpist and court musician to George the Fourth. We wouldn't know, except Edward Jones lived two doors away from William Waterhouse in Mayfair. And he wrote the music and recorded the words. There's only four words, really. Barabulla, Barama, Manjin, Wayan, Guna. Can't be translated at all, except unless you think that Bulla is two and perhaps it's a kangaroo, but I don't think it is. Anyway, Edward Jones wrote it down. It was published in 1811 in England, and there's very few copies of that book itself. I found another one recently, naturally in Cardiff in the Welsh Library.
How was that when you found that song? You must have been over the moon.
Yeah, it's one of those few eureka moments that you have slogging away for years, reading manuscripts and tracing things.
Now, I know that it's been performed most recently, which was a very moving experience.
Yes. Clarence Slocke and Matthew Doyle made a marvellous performance at the opening of the Murray Nowy exhibition that I curated at the Mitchell Library, August to November 2010. And it knocked people's socks off. They were just enthralled because it was almost as if Bennelong and Yamawarini were there. Parabula barama mangi wayenguna parabula barama mangi wayenguna parabula barama mangi wayenguna parabula barama mangi wayenguna.
You say that we don't know what they're singing about. There's been some speculation that they're singing about their wives.
Yeah, well, they said this is a song about our lovers, but the same song, interestingly enough, was recorded by quite a few people in Sydney in manuscript. Dawes has it written down just with a P instead of a B throughout the text. Collins has got the two words, the two sentences reversed. And each time it was given, it was said to be a song about ancestors or a song about leaping porpoises. So it's quite possible.
That could be both.
Yes, songmen, yes, that could be both because ancestors sometimes thought to be porpoises, especially down in Dharawal country. Mm. But songs travel. Songs could be ancient. Songs could have come from inland areas, different languages from hundreds of kilometres away. So it's people like Jeremy Steele, who's an expert in the Sydney language, have not been able to make a translation.
Back at the Governor's house in Sydney Cove, Bennelong wrote a letter to his host, Lord Sydney. We're not sure if Bennelong dictated it to another person or wrote it in his own hand, because the original letter can't be found. Only a copy survives. Captain John Hunter carried the letter with him to England, but nobody knows where it went, or even if Lord Sydney ever received it. Keith Vincent Smith believes the copy of the letter we have today comes from an obscure German astronomy journal published at the start of the 1800s. He's found out more about Bennelong's letter and its own long journey across the globe.
The provenance of the letter itself is very interesting. In the National Library, there's a handwritten copy, and this has been the only one known to us for some time, but poking around recently, I found that both the Mitchell Library and IATSIS, the Institute of Aboriginal Studies in Canberra, have copies of a German book published in 1801 in Graz, and here's the Bennelong letter. And if you look at it carefully, it's obvious that that copy is copied from this printed version. So also we can say then, not only is this the first letter written by an Aboriginal person, but certainly the first printed letter and the first in Europe. In this 1801 monthly statement by an astronomer called Baron Franz Xavier von Zach. And how did it get there? That's also interesting, because John Hunter was the courier.
Sir, I am very well. I hope you are very well. I live at the governor's. I have everyday dinner there. I have not my wife. Another black man took her away. We have had Murray doings. He speared me in the back. But I better now. His name is Garaway. All my friends alive and well. Not me. Go to England no more. I am home now. I hope, sir, you send me anything you please. Hope all well in England. I hope Mrs. Philip very well. You nurse me, madam, when I sick. You're very good, madam. Thank you, madam. And hope you remember me, madam, not forget.
John Hunter took the letter. He talked to Banks. Banks sent the letter to Göttingen, where Blumenbach, the anatomist, the man who coined the word Caucasian, lived, and he sent it on to the astronomer, who published the letter then in his monthly journal, which was a kind of magazine that plotted the stars and gave readings of for various ports around the world. So very valuable piece of publication in those days.
What was the context for the publication in this German journal?
Don't know. It's quite different than most of the things in the journal. It has had reports previously of Cook going to Botany Bay, that you know, voyages in general, and telling the coordinates of those ports. So I guess that's the sort of context of it. But it was a curiosity, I would say. Blumenbach had been sent heads of Port Jackson men, probably one by Philip and probably one by Hunter.
Madam, I want stockings. Thank you, madam. Send me 2 pair stockings. Sir, you give my duty to Lord Sydney. Thank you. Very good, my lord. Hope very well, all family. Sir, please send me some handkerchiefs for pocket. You please, sir. You send me some shoes? 2 pair. You please, sir. Bennelong, 1796.
Bennelong had seen and sat with Philip when he wrote letters, and Philip would write letters and say, you know, I'd like 200 pairs of trousers and, you know, 400 stockings, and Bennelong had seen these arrive by ship months later. So he was in the reciprocal exchange is legendary in Aboriginal society, and he thought that if he wrote a letter, these things would be sent to him. Well, and they might have been also.
Lots of historians have interpreted Bennelong's mood and his personality from that letter, which is difficult given that it is quite brief and that it has a quite specific purpose. But what can it tell us about him?
Well, his character completely. It's a two-sided letter. It's seeking goods and at the same time politely thanking people.
Bennelong is full of contradictions. He survived smallpox and frontier violence, and his first personal encounter with Europeans came when he was kidnapped by them in 1789. But he spent more than half his life in their company. Governor Philip had been ordered by the king to conciliate the affections of the natives and live in kindness with them. But, perhaps terrified of smallpox, no local people would come near the Sydney settlement. So the governor gave an order to bring some in by force. Bennelong and his elder, Colby, were fishing with their Wongal and Gadigal clans at Manly Cove when a party of redcoats, led by Lieutenant William Bradley, made the attack.
They were dancing together when the signal was given by me, and the two poor devils were seized and handed into the boat in an instant. The natives, who were very numerous all round, on seeing us seize those two, immediately advanced with their spears and clubs, but we were too quick for them. The noise of the men, women and children, together with the situation of the two miserable wretches in our possession, was really a most distressing scene. They were much terrified, one of them particularly so. On our landing at Sydney Cove, we were met by Nan Barry, the native boy, much pleased, and he called them by name, Colby and Benalong. They were taken to the governor's house, where they were soon met by Arabu, the native girl. She called them by name, the same as the boy had done, and she was quite frantic with joy. They were assured that they would be well treated, but all that could be said or done was not sufficient to remove the pang which they naturally felt at being torn away from their friends, or to reconcile them to their situation. It gave me great satisfaction to find that neither of them had wife or family who would feel their loss or be distressed by their being taken away. It was by far the most unpleasant service I was ever ordered to execute. Lieutenant William Bradley, Sydney Cove, 1789.
Yeah, this is Philip's diplomacy, because he has orders from George III to live in peace and amity with the indigenous people. Nobody had come in since February 1788, when he captured Arabanoo not long after. But Arabanoo, a man also captured at Manly Cove, died of smallpox in May that year, unfortunately. But hadn't been able to give them very much information. In Benalong, they had a lucky choice.
We soon discovered that one was a chief, or distinguished person, among those of the tribe of Cadigal. His name was Colby. He was a man of about 35 years of age. The other was about 25 years old, and was called by several different names, such as Benalong, Voldratuye, or Volaraveri. This man was a very good-looking young fellow, of a pleasant, lively disposition. Captain John Hunter, 1789.
Colby quickly got away, chewed through his ropes, and his keeper was given a few lashes in return for that. But Benalong made friends with Philip. 3 months after Benalong had been captured, Philip told Lord Sydney in London by letter, these were the clans and the dispositions in the immediate Port Jackson area. All the information from Benalong, who's happy to give it.
But how do they communicate? I mean, Benalong, within a 3 month period, had obviously learned.
Clever man, he'd learned enough English, yes.
His powers of mind were certainly far above mediocrity. He acquired knowledge, both of our manners and language, faster than his predecessor had done. He willingly communicated information, sang, danced, and capered. He told us all the customs of his country and all the details of his family economy. Love and war seemed his favourite pursuits, in both of which he had suffered severely. Watkin Tench, 1790.
After a few months at the governor's house, Benalong, like Colby, ran away. Interestingly, about 6 months later, he returned of his own volition. But why? Keith Vincent Smith thinks he'd been sent back to try and smooth out diplomatic relations with the Europeans.
Well, he sits as a powerful person who was working very cleverly, first of all, to gain material goods. He got iron hatchets, which he traded down to other people. He was given, you know, metal fishing spears, lots of advantages, clothing, food, when he wanted it, for him and his people. And he was looking after them, really, by making what really is an unwritten treaty with Philip, coming in peacefully. 14 people had been speared up till that time for about 2 years, till Benalong boarded the HMS Atlantic with Governor Philip and his companion Yamarawani in November 1792 to go to England. There was peace. There was no people being killed.
Benalong and his people had decided to collaborate with the colony. There were benefits for him, his family, and the Sydney clans. He tried to build a relationship with Governor Philip based on kinship and mutual obligation. Watkin Tench observed the two men.
Although I call him only Benalong, he has besides several appellations, and for a while he chose to be distinguished by that of Wallara Wari. As a mark of affection and respect to the governor, Bennelong conferred on him the name Wallarawari, and sometimes called him Bean Enna, meaning father, adopting to himself the name of governor. This interchange of names, we found, is a constant symbol of friendship among them. Watkin Tench, 1790.
He often urged Philip to kill all the Cammeraygal, the North Shore people, he was at enmity with people at Botany Bay, and particularly Metty, the chief of the Gweigal, and he abducted the daughter of Metty, Gurabarabula, which means two fire sticks, her totem name, and within a few months, he was able to say to Philip, "I've made peace. The Botany Bay people will not throw spears anymore." He was seen with the Cammeraygal over at Kirribilli, eating bush tucker over there, eating G-bungs, in fact, when they were in season.
So he was smart enough to use his association with Philip as a chance to politically advance his people.
Exactly, to make himself a more powerful person. And then this continued with his alliances he formed by the marriages of his sisters and to powerful brothers-in-law.
What was the context, I guess, for his decision to go back? I mean, given you mentioned before that Aribanu died of smallpox, that would have, and many hundreds of Aboriginal people died of smallpox.
Half by his account, half the Aboriginal people, which Philip had only estimated as 1,500 people on the coast, so he left with about 800 people. And the Cattigal, Gollaby and his people were just three people left out of what might have been a clan of 50 to 60 men, women and children in 1788. I can't think for Bennelong, but I can walk with him from what I've read, I suppose. He was after his own advancement. He was intrigued by this colonial life. And it did end up in him, you know, going to Britain and living in a Georgian townhouse in Mayfair, among other things.
With the governor there embarked, voluntarily and cheerfully, two natives of this country, Bennelong and Yemarawani, two men who were much attached to his person, and who withstood, at the moment of their departure, the united distress of their wives and the dismal lamentations of their friends, to accompany him to England, a place they knew well was a great distance from them. David Collins, 1792.
Eora called the foreign settlers men from the clouds, Birra Walgal. And there's a little paragraph in Dawes where he calls England Englander. So he just knew, it, for all he knew, it might have been in the stars, but he knew it was a long way away. And he just a few days out from Sydney, they crossed the line, or a few weeks out, sorry. He was confronted with this figure of Neptune, which is an old sailor dressed in a seaweed petticoat and shaving people with rusty bits of anchor. He and Yemawarani both thought, this is a real man from the sea. So, you know, it was inconceivable what he saw.
Just to clarify what you mean is when old sailors cross the equator, there's a little ceremony they perform.
The crossing the line ceremony, in which people who hadn't crossed the line before are usually ducked in a tub and shaved. Yes.
The journey took 8 months, sailing via Cape Horn and Rio. The two men might as well have been travelling to the moon. When their ship landed in Cornwall, they went by carriage to London, but there was no great excitement about their arrival. A couple of newspaper reports, that's it.
Nobody was there to greet them, but on the 24th of May 1793, the day they arrived, they were already outfitted with breeches and ruffled shirts and spotted waistcoats and buckled shoes and topcoats in the Regency fashion. So they were well looked after. They bought their hats from Busby's in the Strand. And later on they had... All this is in Treasury bills, and you can trace the expenses for their outings in carriages, visits to the theatre, washing and servants who attended them at the house of William Waterhouse in Mayfair near Berkeley Square.
Two sooty natives of New South Wales, brought over by Governor Phillip, were introduced to several persons of consequence. They do not by any means correspond with the description we at first received of our Antipodes, for instead of that vacuity of intellect and barrenness of observation which we were led to expect of them, one in particular displays much shrewdness and curiosity. A very merry fellow. He says he regrets nothing so much as the inconvenience he finds in the absence of his three wives, for whom he had not yet been able to find a substitute in this country.
What was the thinking behind taking them to Britain in the first place? Was this to show the king the natives of the colony, or was it an experiment in trying to civilise them? What was the thinking?
More the latter, and I dispute the fact that he might have visited the king, because there actually is no evidence, except it's one of those things that keeps getting repeated in history books without anyone looking at the sources. Now, Phillips wrote a letter to Lord Sydney about a year before they left, saying he would bring Ben along because he was an intelligent man and he would show him more or less how people lived in, you know, civilization. That's the proper outlook for them, and that's probably why later on they were given lessons in reading and writing English language.
Bennelong and Yemarawani went to the theatre, appeared in Parliament, visited museums and churches. But the punishing cold and damp of London made them both sick. Yemarawani was deathly ill with a chest infection when the London Observer reported.
The two natives of New South Wales, at present in this metropolis, are in appearance scarcely human. They continue to reside in Mount Street, Berkeley Square, in the neighbourhood of which they are to be seen daily. They cannot walk without the support of sticks, and appear to have lost all that agility they are said formerly to have possessed. One of them appears much emaciated. Notwithstanding they are indulged in every inclination, they seem constantly dejected, and every effort to make them laugh has for many months past been ineffectual.
Yemarawani was 19. He had a weak chest, obviously. They both became ill, and it's only in November 1793 they were both seen by the Observer's reporter as tottering around, not being able to walk without walking sticks. So they had a doctor, and they had given various medicines. Mr. Vivers was the apothecary who dispensed medicine to them. So Bennelong did recover, but Yemarawani was so ill they were moved to a country house at Eltham in Kent, which is now a South London suburb, and not far from Lord Sydney's house at Chislehurst, where obviously Bennelong often went to visit him while Yemarawani was ill. But before that, they went to places like the Tower of London and St Paul's. They went on, you know, a carriage was hired, 2 and 6 pence for the day. And this marvellous thing at the Tower was the zoo. So they saw giraffes, elephants, bears, wolves, and all of these various animals. So you can imagine the conversation around the campfire back in Sydney after 1795.
It seems a miracle that Bennelong returned to that campfire at all. According to Captain John Hunter, Bennelong was stricken with grief over the death of young Yemarawani and deeply distressed at having to bury him in England. Bennelong himself was gravely ill when he asked for passage home in 1794. He boarded the Reliance, growing sicker by the day, but the ship sat in port for several months before finally sailing in 1795.
The surviving man is with me, but I think in a precarious state of health. He has for the past 12 months been flattered with the hope of seeing again his native country, a happiness which he has fondly looked forward to. But so long a disappointment, has much broken his spirit, and the coldness of the weather here has so frequently laid him up that I am apprehensive his lungs are affected. That was the cause of the other's death. I do all I can to keep him up, but I'm still doubtful of his living. Captain John Hunter, to the Under-Secretary of the Home Office, 1795.
He boarded the ship in July at Chatham. This ship did not leave till November. Of the 3.5 years he was away, 18 months were at sea on ships or in docks. And he began to be very ill, and Captain John Hunter, who was returning as governor, wrote a letter saying he feared he might die. But fortunately, George Bass and Matthew Flinders were aboard, and George Bass was a surgeon. He treated Bennelong. In return, Bennelong gave them all lessons in the English, in the Sydney language. And Flinders and Bass were saved by that when they met Botany Bay men and they were being threatened by others down in the Illawarra years later. And he gave to Daniel Payne, the master shipbuilder, who had on board the ship the first Tom Thumb, a nice long vocabulary also that we can read today.
Back home, Bennelong returned to his own people. The newspaper reports of the time lamented his decision.
For some time after his return, it is true, he assumed the manners, the dress, and the consequence of a European, and treated his countrymen with a distance which evinced the sense he entertained of his own increased importance. So much pains had been taken for his improvement, both when he separated from his countrymen and since his return to New South Wales. But he has subsequently taken to the woods again, returned to his old habits, and now lives in the same manner as those who have never mixed with the civilized world. Sometimes, indeed, he holds intercourse with the colony, but every effort uniformly fails to draw him once again into the circle of polished society, since he prefers to taste of liberty among his native scenes.
The papers put it down to his inability to be civilized, not the traumatic nature of his journey, or his desire to be among his own family again. Keith Vincent Smith also thinks Sydney had changed too much for Bennelong's taste.
And Hunter was now the governor, but he didn't have that same strength of friendship with Captain Hunter. We would take his clothes off every couple of weeks and he'd go into the bush. And people wrote letters to Lord Sydney and said, you know, Bennelong has returned to his old ways, and he would soon probably go back to the bush. And that's what he did. He constantly came into Sydney or Parramatta, but gravitated towards the Ryde area, Kissing Point as it was called, now modern Putney, a suburb of Sydney, where a group of people were seen by Holt, the Irish rebel, and he described 100 people coming in for breakfast with him, and he said, Bennelong is the chief. He would ask, tell his people to behave, otherwise it would be Murray Tat-Tat, which means he'd kill them. Then he would send his wives to get mogra, so that's fish.
The natives of this country are more and more savage. Though some of them have been quite civilized, they prefer wandering stark naked in the bush, living on worms and insects and so forth. This is the case with Bennelong, who was in England. He visits the settlements now and then, is very polite, begs a loaf, and departs. The Reverend W. Pascoe Crook, 1796.
It's obvious Bennelong was leading and still respected by his people, a clan of 100 people.
But had clearly chosen to abandon white society, or yes, had chosen to just come and visit from time to time.
Conveniently then, he settled at James Squire's Orchard, and this was the brewer, who was a friendly man at Kissing Point. And there's a reason for that, is that he's a gypsy extract. His parents were involved in a big case in which a girl was abducted in London several years before he was transported here, and gypsy people have oral history, gypsy people have totems, and like the fir tree, etc., for their clans. They have personal totem names also, so there's a lot in common. And I believe that's why Squires was sympathetic to Bennelong.
Bennelong died on Sunday morning last at Kissing Point. Of this veteran champion of the native tribe, little favorable can be said. His voyage to and benevolent treatment in Great Britain produced no change whatever in his manners and inclinations, which were naturally barbarous and ferocious. The principal officers of government had for many years endeavored by the kindest of usage to wean him from his original habits and draw him into a relish for civilized life. But every effort was in vain exerted, and for the last few years he has been but little noticed. His propensity for drunkenness was inordinate, and when in that state he was insolent, menacing, and overbearing. In fact, he was a thorough savage, not to be warped from the form and character that nature gave him by all the efforts that mankind could use.
Yes, Bennelong died at Kissing Point in 3rd of January 1813, so it will soon be 200 years anniversary of his death, and I believe that should be marked in some way because this is the most significant Aboriginal figure and perhaps the most understood Aboriginal person of that period, and he's part of our shared history and whatever we know from those colonial times, he looms as a large figure in it.
He's often portrayed in history as having died broken-hearted, really.
Yeah, I don't think that's so. And as far as the steam goes, Nan Barry, a little Cadigal boy who was born in suffering from smallpox in 1789, asked to be buried in Bennelong's grave with him, and he was. When he died in 1821, he'd become a great voyager also, constantly went to Norfolk Island on HMS Reliance. And Bidgey Bidgey, who was a relative of Bennelong, had been made a chief by Macquarie and was for 20 years chief of Kissing Point, also asked to be buried in his grave. But squires had died who'd arranged the previous burials, and we don't know where Bidgey Bidgey was buried, but it might well be at Abbotsford, opposite, across the river, because that place was called Bidgey Bidgey.
Where's Bennelong's resting place?
Bennelong's resting place is, shall I say, at the intersection of two roads near a park where there is actually a monument to him put up in 1988 by the Bicentennial Authority. And it's at Kissing Point, quite close to Bennelong Park.
Bennelong and Yimirawani's song was performed by Matthew Doyle and Clarence Slockley. Readings were by Eden Falk, Drayton Morley, David Baldwin, David Downer and Rico Adran. And thanks to Keith Vincent Smith. Part 2 of Bennelong's story is next. Almost 200 years after it was lost to us, Bennelong's grave may have been found. You're with Hindsight on ABC Radio National with me, Michelle Rayner.
Parabola, Parama, Mangiwayanguna, Parabola, Parama. guna parabola barama magni vayanguna parabola barama magni vayanguna parabola barama magni vayanguna parabola barama magni vayanguna Parabola Barama Mani Wanguna 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 Parabola Barama Mani Wanguna
The exact location of Bennelong's grave has been lost to history for almost two centuries. There's been plenty of speculation about its whereabouts and much debate about the accuracy of the historical records. And over time, an entire suburb has grown over his resting place on the property of his friend, the brewer James Squire. Last week, a physical geographer announced that he'd found Bennelong's grave, right underneath the nature strip, outside a home, on a busy road in the Sydney suburb of Putney. Lorena Allen spoke to him about this new find.
I'm Peter Mitchell. I formerly was the head of Department of Physical Geography at Macquarie University, and I've been out of the system for about a decade doing environmental science consulting. And most of my clients have been Sydney archaeologists, and so I've worked a lot with Aboriginal groups and on Aboriginal sites in particular. I'm also a member of the Wright Council Heritage Advisory Committee, and about 12, 15 months ago, they expressed interest in locating Bennelong's grave, which was known to be down in Putney. And I undertook the task, thinking initially that this was probably pretty hopeless because the place had been so built over and urbanised that the chances of it having been destroyed were high. But I then had a go, and we have had some success.
When you say you had a go, what did you do? Well, how did you go about trying to locate the grave?
The first thing I did was simply to go back to all of the earlier accounts of where the grave was supposed to be. That included fairly modern histories of Putney and Ryde, all of which repeated the earlier stories, and it goes back and back and back. And eventually I got back to the 1820s and even to 1813 when Bennelong was actually died. And those earliest accounts I took to be the most reliable. And they were contradictory in themselves. And so it was no wonder that people later on down the track didn't get the story quite right.
When you say contradictory, were there a number of differing accounts as to where he was buried?
Yes. The very first account said that he was buried in James Squire's orchard. The second account said that he was buried in James Squire's garden. And I thought to myself, well, is the orchard and the garden the same thing? I'm not sure. The third account said he was buried amongst the orange trees in the garden, which didn't help.
The orchard in the garden.
Yes. But then we got lucky and we found a map that had been made of Squire's properties after his death. And that clearly showed the boundaries of the orchard and the garden, and they were two distinctly different places. From there on, we came up through time to see if we could narrow it down somewhat, and it wasn't until we got to a letter to the Herald in 1927 by Charles Watson that said, we have an Aboriginal grave on my property, it used to be Squire's place, this must be Bennelong. So then the question became, okay, where was Charles Watson's property? And that was a fairly straightforward land title search to pin that location down. And a later account, 1947, of a bi-historian and writer who had talked to Watson, said that the grave was under the tennis court. And then by comparing air photographs from the 30s and the 40s and putting the tennis court onto the modern map and putting the tennis court onto the orchard, it all came together and it all narrowed down to a particular little spot on the boundary of the orchard on Watson's property. And that was the first approach, and we were fairly confident that, hey, there it is. When we compared that with the modern-day map, we found, lo and behold, it was on the intersection of a couple of streets, and the grave was probably either under the road or under the nature strip. Didn't look like it was private property at all. That was great.
And it's on Watson Street, is it?
It is indeed on Watson Street, yes, which was one of the early parts of the subdivision, yes.
So you must have been quite excited to be able to say that with some certainty that that is where
it is. Yes. I obviously felt I had errors in my interpretation because all of this mapping work had been done by hand, just laying maps over maps, and you get scale distortions and difficulties at times. So I asked the surveyors to check it, and instead of simply going out and checking my work, they took an independent approach, and they took a photograph that was in Ryde Library and in the Mitchell Library, which showed, or allegedly showed, the grave, and the photograph was clearly taken in the front yard of a house, and the front fence was there and a mound of bricks in front of that, which is said to be the grave. In the background, there were some fairly hazy details across the harbour, but it was enough for the surveyors to say, ah, that's the chimney of such and such a factory and a couple of other identifiable points. And by doing some fairly fancy maths, which I didn't understand, they were able to resect all of that. And they came up with basically the same spot that I had picked out. So that was a quite independent check. We're using an entirely different approach, and the two crosses more or less coincided. So I think we've found the location of the grave. We certainly haven't found the grave. We haven't done any sort of investigation to follow up on that, and that may be the next stage, but that's not a decision for either council or myself. But we're pretty confident that that is the right place.
Well, who's going to make that decision?
Ultimately, I think it'll be the Aboriginal community, because it really is there in their interest to follow this through. Council at the present time is negotiating with a couple of parties there to get a meeting together between all of us to see where we should go next. There are a couple of options for the next step. One would be to do some ground-penetrating radar work, which might show up a grave. It certainly won't show up anything in the way of skeletons or anything of that nature, but it also may not show it up, and so it could be quite a lot of money spent for no real result. And the other option is to say simply that Bennelong should be left to rest in peace. We now are quite confident that this is pretty close to the spot, within a few metres, and perhaps we should do something else in terms of commemorating his life, because in 2013 it's 200 years since he died.
There is a plaque across the street in a park that commemorates Bennelong and says this is near where he is buried. Are you and is Ryde Council thinking of something bigger than that for him?
The plaque that's in the park was put there by the Historical Society, I think, for the bicentenary, 1988, and that was as close as they felt they could get to it at the time, and it simply says that Bennelong is buried hereabouts, or words to that effect. We could move that plaque, or we could go for something entirely different, something new. And again, it's a question for what do the Aboriginal people want to do. Mm. Bennelong's grave site is such an important site, both to Aboriginal people and white Australians, that I think it's of national interest, and so funding could become available from state or federal governments.
Almost 200 years since his death, and we've only just come to maybe know where he's buried. What do you think that says about
it? I think it says some pretty awful things about white Australians' attitudes towards Aboriginal people in the early 19th century. Bennelong has had a really bad run in history. He's been generally written off as a drunkard and a violent fool. Reading all of the information again, and particularly looking at the work that Keith Vincent Smith and others have done in recent years, it's pretty clear he was much more than that. He was a very important Aboriginal man in his own right. He was a very important go-between with Governor Phillip and the first settlers in Australia. It didn't all work out as you know, it was almost a miracle it would have been if it had worked out. But reading it again, I think we've maligned him. But that was typical of that time. And the fact that the grave was lost, inverted commas, people always sort of knew more or less where it was, is just a question of the lack of value that was placed on that. It wasn't seen to be important. And so it sort of disappeared from history, except in a few notes in history books, some of which are wrong, and some memories of people that lived in the vicinity and so on.
I guess it's testament to the strength of his character that he's still talking to us centuries later.
Oh, very much so, yes. You could certainly say that.
What would you like to see happen in terms of commemorating Bennelong?
The best suggestion that has been put to me, and which I would certainly be in favour of, is that we treat the road intersection as some sort of special little park, make it a particular place. It should be listed at least as a state heritage place, and I prefer to see it listed at the national level so that it is adequately protected in a legal framework. We could treat the road surface with some fancy paving and plant up all the nature strips and make it an attractive spot. And I would like to see a commemorative artwork of some kind commissioned from the Aboriginal community to put on that corner. And I think that would mark the spot very effectively. But others may have different views, and I'm not pushing that one in particular.
It's nice to know that he might be there and that we've found him. Now, the conversation can start, I guess, about what to do.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think that's as far as we need to go, that he is here. All the indications are that none of the ground disturbance so far has been sufficient to have wiped him out or excavated him, and I don't really want to dig him up myself because I think that would be unreasonable and an unnecessary disturbance. Locating the site, I think, is very important. Whether or not we've actually got a grave there is of lesser importance.
Associate Professor of Physical Geography at Macquarie University, Peter Mitchell. And Ryde Council are talking with local Aboriginal people about taking the next step to verify the location. To find out more about Bennelong, to view images and listen to his song, just head to our website. That's abc.net.au/rn/hindsight. Today's program was produced by Lorena Allam and the sound engineer was Phil McKellar. Next week on Hindsight, we remember a much-loved and brilliant colleague who passed away last week. Tony Barrell was a masterful documentary maker, and his contribution to the ABC has been extraordinary. A journalist in both TV and radio, as a producer of wonderfully creative radio features, and as a writer and producer of drama. And in 2005, as Sydney's Everleigh Railway Yards were transformed from a century-old industrial and working site into a cultural and performance space, Tony Barrell captured the history of this important place.
In the building where they used to make steam engines, there's a new company called Australian Photonics, where they're doing new work, and they're actually making them on fibre optics. And just outside their little cubicle here, there's a row of wash basins. And these are the basins which Louis Cavalieri and his comrades had to fight to get installed here all those years ago in the 1960s. The plaque says it's been put up by ATP Innovations. In the early days of the railways, the hot water for washing was provided by shop boys tossing rivets into the furnace and then recovering them and later placing them in a bucket of water, heat up the water. And the men seeking better working conditions actually went on strike to get proper washing facilities, which resulted in hundreds of wash basins being strategically positioned throughout the workshops. However, that industrial win became a bitter pill when the railways required that they wash in their own time. Anyway, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 on each side here, just sitting here in the atrium of the National Innovation Centre.
That's Remembering Everleigh, produced by the late, great Tony Barrell, next week on Hindsight.